The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
In the two-part series, host Alora Hastings sits down with Dr. Jennifer Carson, NPS STEM Director, for a conversation about her journey from astrophysics research to science outreach, the challenges and rewards of making complex ideas accessible to the public, and the role of STEM in inspiring the next generation. She also shares what's ahead for this year's Discovery Day and how the event connects Naval Postgraduate School research with the wider community.
Hello, everyone. Alora here with the Trident Room podcast. Before we jump into this week's episode, quick update that the dates in the episode you're about to hear have changed. The new date for Discovery Day at NPS will be on 1 May. That's a Friday, May 1st, 2026. And to find out any information about Discovery Day, you can go to nps.edu and search Discovery Day in the search bar. So without further ado, let's jump right on in.
Part one of a two-part episode.
Welcome, everyone, to the Trident Room podcast. My name is Alora Hastings, and today we are joined by Dr. Jennifer Carson, NPS STEM Director, to talk about one of the most exciting events of the year here at NPS, Discovery Day. We will hear about her journey in astrophysics, her role at NPS, and have some fun with a quick game at the end. Welcome, Dr. Carson.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Before we begin, a little fun fact about me. I'm actually named after one of the moons of Jupiter. Alora is a moon of Jupiter. With that in mind, do you have a favorite moon of Jupiter?
Europa.
Europa.
Yes.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Io.
I know that it is actually Europa. Do you want me to tell you why now?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
When I was in graduate school, we were admitting to ourselves that Europa was probably covered in ice. And it was back when thinking that there was water on any other planet or surface, you know, outside of the Earth felt incredibly exotic. So just admitting that there was ice was one thing. But then imagining that there might be water under that ice, an enormous ocean covering the whole planet, was almost more than people could bear. And I just love how much that's changed, because I used to imagine whales and dolphins, you know, European whales and dolphins living in that under ice ocean, and the creatures that really might be there when we were still saying, like, I don't know if it's H2O. And now we know so much more. Now we know that there most likely is an entire ocean of liquid water covering that planet. Water formed the valleys on Mars, et cetera. It's not such an exotic thing to think about anymore, but that always captured my imagination, the idea of that planet.
I love that visual so much. I'm just picturing, I mean, of course, film and movies, whenever they go into outer space and do like celestial whales, I was just picturing that with like the glitter all around it.
Exactly.
How cool. Well, thank you for sharing that.
One thing that is really fascinating to me about any field, but astrophysics is the one that I've been watching now for my career, and I'm not that old, but like watching for a couple decades, is how much things change and how much something that used to be science fiction is now just considered commonplace. When I was even in graduate school, my master's program, so not even the PhD program, but when I was in my master's program, there were still people who said black holes cannot be a real thing. It's not physical. I don't care what happens in the math. It doesn't happen in the real world. And then Andrea Ghez comes along right after many, many others saying it's got to be a thing. Like there's just no other choice. It's got to be a thing. But she had to prove that it was a thing. So suddenly this thing that was every bit as much science fiction as a wormhole is now, or, you know, whatever the equivalent is now, became common. Same thing happened with water on other planets. Same thing happened with extrasolar planets. I was in graduate school at San Francisco State with Jeff Marcy, who was one of the first people. He discovered maybe the second or third extrasolar planet, but he's just discovered most of them. So what he did is, he was at Berkeley and he didn't get tenure, so he came over to San Francisco State and he thought his career was over because he was just at a lowly Cal State. So he's like, well, as long as my career is over, I will build this thing that I heard someone talk about, which is this Doppler shift detector that could detect wobbles in suns because there are planets around them. I'm only doing this because I have nothing to lose. This really is basically how I hope Jeff agrees with it, but this is the way I remember this story. And He revolutionized planetary science by discovering that not only were there extrasolar planets, but they're everywhere. And then because of his discovery, we sent up an observatory, a space observatory that does nothing but detect more. And now there are thousands and thousands of extrasolar planets known. And we know that it's only the tip of the iceberg. We know that the only thing that's limiting our number is our ability to see them. So things that were science fiction have become not science fiction just in my lifetime. So when your jaw drops about Mars, you know, I was thinking today, I can just say with a straight face, Mars is coming, because I've seen enough of the things that used to seem like science fiction just come into the mainstream. Oh, what gets in the way of scientific discovery? Not asking big enough questions. We don't know what's on Mars until we think to ask, like, how do we find out what's on Mars? Or can we go there? Right? Until we ask, can we go there? We don't start figuring out what the constraints are to see what would it take. But so far, every time we ask a question, we come up with an answer eventually.
Ask a question and be willing to make those risks. He wouldn't have taken those risks if he had landed that 10-year job.
Pushy job. That's right. And then he would be a run-of-the-mill physicist at Berkeley instead of a trailblazer.
That's an incredible, definitely two different paths, and his ended up
making a huge difference.
Making a universe of a difference.
That's right, as it were. And there are a lot of stories like that. People who don't do the risky thing until they think their career is over. This happens in all fields. This is not just a STEM phenomenon. But it's sad for me to think there's something about mainstream career paths that discourages that kind of out-of-the-box thinking. And I think it's part of, to come back to Einstein and Maxwell, it's part of why I revere them so much. Einstein was not a step away from where before. He was in an entirely different universe from what anyone else was thinking. And to have that kind of mind where you just look at the problem and nothing but the problem and you are not affected. This is the hero version of Einstein. I'm sure he was affected. Oh, sorry. But you're not affected by what is considered to be common knowledge or common sense. And then you can break through to what is actually more true than what we knew before.
That's amazing. All because I asked what your favorite moon of Jupiter.
I know, right? Right? That's right. That's true.
All answers point to Jupiter?
Maybe so.
Maybe so.
All answers point to whales on Europa.
Whales on Europa. I like that. We need to have Midjourney create us an image for this episode that's like whales on Europa.
I would love to see that, really. Because if you can imagine microbes on other planets, why not, you know, megafauna?
Yeah. So I understand you got your PhD in astrophysics from UCLA. What sparked your initial interest in astrophysics?
So I liked physics in high school, and my father, who is a huge reader, was trying to find the right book for me and so bought me Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking. It had just come out. Now I'm dated. And I fell in love with cosmology because of that book. So decided that I wanted to pursue astrophysics and specifically learn as much as I could about cosmology. I didn't understand the book until I was a freshman in college, but the first break, MIT has a January break period, and I basically spent that January reading Brief History of Time, and that sparked my curiosity in cosmology.
That's amazing. I don't know this answer. Can you explain the difference between cosmology and astrophysics?
Absolutely. So astrophysics is the general term for the physics of astronomical phenomena, which is everything from planetary science, right? So what's happening, the physics behind how the planets work, to stars, galaxies, and, you know, the universe as a whole. Cosmology is specifically the field of astrophysics that covers the structure and evolution of the universe as a whole. So it's the Big Bang, what happened in the beginning, right? The cosmological background radiation that we detected, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, that sort of thing. That's cosmology.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. Looking back over your research journey, you've completed a lot of different projects, I'm sure. Can you share a memorable moment that stands out to you?
Yeah, I loved this question because I really had to look back. So much of a research career is sitting in front of a computer. But what I realized was really memorable in hindsight is observational astronomy. So as opposed to theoretical astronomy. Theoretical astronomy, you're writing the code, you're building the models, and then you tell someone else to go out and see whether or not they can prove or disprove. Observational observational astronomy, you take the data yourself and analyze it. So I was an observational astronomer. And the visits to the various telescopes are what really stuck with me. And I thought observational astronomy is a sort of adventure sport because you have these telescopes that are high up on mountains in very remote places because the sky has to be dark. It's the middle of the night, which also always makes you feel like you're doing weird work. You're doing it in the middle of the night. I went to the Keck telescopes 6 times in my first 2 years in graduate school and did get to go up to the top of Mauna Kea, which is at 14,000 feet, and see the telescope itself. Got to go to the Palomar telescope, which is Caltech's big telescope in the middle of Southern California forest. And my PhD thesis took place on an airbase in New Mexico in a concrete tower where we built all of our own equipment 30 floors up in a big solar array. So all this machinery and crazy equipment in the middle of the night, that probably is what sticks out to me as the most memorable kind of part of my research experience.
That's amazing. And I think I would prefer the adventure aspect of research to the computer sitting at a desk aspect.
I think a lot of people do. And then your colleague was talking about Contact and being so moved by Contact, the Jodie Foster film about the woman who started SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Same thing there. What's moving about that movie is where you get to see the telescope and she gets to go and use this enormous, beautiful machine.
I have not seen it, so I'll have to add it to my list.
It's a classic.
This one's not a fun fact, but it's considered a fun fact for me. For some reason, I've missed out on a lot of film history, and so I'm going back and rewatching a lot of things, and this is one that it sounds right up my alley. I'll have to add it to my list.
Oh, great. Yeah, you totally should. It's very good. I mean, it's not a true classic, but it's worth it.
Especially with the high recommendations. So what do you consider, I don't know if you keep up to date with astrophysics now being part of the STEM director here, but what do you consider the most exciting recent discovery in astrophysics?
This is where I wanted to show you this picture. So I'm going to fudge this question. There are recent discoveries, and the couple that I would mention is, because I know these people, a friend of mine from undergrad is the person leading the team that did the first direct imaging of a black hole. It's a small community, so you end up knowing the people who break out. And I was at UCLA with Andrea Ghez, who was one of the people to win the Nobel Prize for discovering that there's a black hole in the center of our galaxy. So those are some cool ones. What you're holding, though, is some pictures that I had printed out of what I consider, they're like canvas prints, of what I consider to be the most revolutionary plots in all of astrophysics. It turns out they're all cosmology. The one in the bottom right corner is the first detection of a gravitational wave. I love that one because it's so spare. It doesn't even need axes. It's just the signal is a function of time. That's all you need to know. That's actually the picture that the Nobel committee put out when that discovery won the Nobel. That was LIGO and maybe 10 years ago or so. The one on the left is Joe Taylor's discovery of, so he was, this is going to take a minute, but I'd like.
Yeah. And for our listeners out there, we will show this photo in the link, in the episode link. So make sure you go check it out and follow along with us as we're going through these photos.
The one in the lower left corner is, so Joe Taylor was a researcher at Princeton, and he measured for years the spin down rate of pulsars. So a pulsar is a very rapidly spinning neutron star, but its spin rate decreases with time. It slows down with time. And the reason why, according to general relativity, the reason why is because it is emitting gravitational waves. So see bottom right. And the data are those blue points. You can zoom in on it and see the data are the blue line or the...
Blue line, red point.
Okay, yeah. So the data are the red points. And the line is the prediction made by general relativity. And you can see how perfectly they match. This observation, these data, and you can see it's time on the x-axis. You can see how long this took, is the first really direct, unequivocal confirmation of general relativity. So that right there is the confirmation of general relativity. He won the Nobel Prize for it. I got to meet him a couple years after that. That was very cool. And then on the upper right, you have Van Gogh, because I think he holds his own with all of these geniuses. But in the upper right is all of the data for the determination of the Hubble constant, which is basically the determination of how fast the universe is expanding. The reason I really like that one is because that took an international, a global effort to determine. So all the different colors of the different data points are different separate observations, many of them from the Hubble telescope, but not all of them. And I just love being reminded that in order to get some things right, it really takes people working in all different fields and coming together.
Yeah, which ties into our topic of Discovery Day. We'll get into that a little later. A lot of great minds coming together.
Long answer, but I hope that helps.
It's wonderful. And we will post that photo in the episode link. So go check that out. Astrophysics can be complex. I mean, as we've heard just in these few questions, how do you approach explaining these concepts to a general audience?
Once I left research, I taught physics for 20 years in college. So I thought a lot about how to explain these concepts to a general audience or to a beginning audience. And a couple things stick out. One is break it down, tell a story. I mean, if there's any way, in stellar evolution, galactic evolution, there are a lot of stories in astrophysics, the evolution of the universe as a whole. You know, it started with the Big Bang, then what happened, because people remember stories. Analogies are always helpful. I just gave a talk to a bunch of scouts, and it was like basically kind of 12 to 14-year-olds and talking about cosmology, black holes. And when I talk about the expansion of the universe, I didn't make this up. This is the standard analogy for the expansion of the universe is raisin bread rising in the oven, because the galaxies are like raisins and the bread itself is like space-time and the whole thing expands. And the reason everything seems to move away from everything else is not because you're in the center, but it looks like that from everybody's point of view. And if you imagine yourself on any one of those raisins, then you can imagine why it looks like everything is moving away from you.
I don't think I will look at raisin bread the same ever again. That's really cool.
Except analogies always break down. This one breaks down because you cannot get outside of the raisin bread in order to observe it. The bread is the four-dimensional space-time. So, but you need analogies when you're trying to describe things like that.
Absolutely.
And the thing that I always do in physics also is with time, you just learn. I think everybody who teaches knows this, where people are likely to get stumped. So you just start to anticipate that. So I start to be able to say like, okay, you're going to think it's this, right? But it's this other thing. So just time and experience helps.
20 years. You definitely have time and experience breaking it down. I like what you said about telling stories. I think that resonates especially well with students who don't have as much experience in the field and with science. In thinking about outreach, what role do you believe public engagement plays in scientific discovery?
Actually, before we go on about stories, it just occurs to me that that is something that's really powerful about outreach events like Discovery Day, because part of the story is this person that you're meeting, right, this role model, this flesh and blood person does this thing, and then they remember the field, the research, because they remember the person.
Absolutely. For me, looking back to my childhood too, anytime there was an event where I got to meet someone experienced in something that I was interested in, it made a lasting impact on me. So Discovery Day is huge for our community and giving students that opportunity.
Tell me again what the question was that I didn't quite get to. Oh, the public engagement.
So what role do you believe public engagement plays in scientific discovery?
I think public engagement is key and sometimes hard to quantify its effect on discovery. It's an interesting question because you didn't say like on the advancement, you know, but like new discoveries. But if we look at an example like NASA, public engagement is essential to the evolution of NASA as a whole. They just wouldn't exist without the excitement that they engender in the general public. And so, I mean, NASA is a great example of an institution that has figured out how much public engagement is needed. And then you have examples like SETI, which I mentioned earlier, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is an institute now. Jill Tarter, who started SETI, is another great example. She has this crazy idea, which is that there is intelligent life on other planets, and that she believes in that enough that she's going to go after it with like research dollars and sophisticated research. But she has engaged the public, or did back when she started. You could put an app, basically a program on your computer to process SETI data just in the background in your computer's free time, and therefore distributed this data processing job, like this huge job, to whoever was willing to do it. That is just a lovely example of, okay, if I can't get the funding for the supercomputer because not enough people believe that there is extraterrestrial life, then I will just get the general public involved instead. And it's one of those discoveries that it may never happen. Probability is very small. And if it does, it will change everything. And so somebody should be looking for it, even if most people are not looking for it, even if most people poo-poo it. somebody should be looking for it. And it is a perfect example of something that needs public engagement.
I'm curious. This reminds me of one of the newest Pixar movies called Elio. Have you seen that yet?
I have not.
It reminds me very much of the story that you're telling about this woman, Dr. Tartar. And I'm wondering if maybe they took inspiration from it. So that's exciting. I'll have to look into it. It's very much worth watching. Another movie. You give me a scientific movie, I'll give you a Pixar movie.
Excellent. Yeah. I love Pixar. I'm happy for that.
If you could collaborate with any scientist, living or historical, who would it be and why?
I loved this question. Collaborate. I'm just going to say something very mundane, but it's a shout out to my dissertation advisor. I would in a heartbeat collaborate with him again. Renee Ong. No, I'm laughing because Alora is giving me a, oh, that's so sweet face.
Like the Pixar, like puppy dog, like, oh.
But he was this unusual combination of incredibly smart. UCLA poached him away from Chicago, University of Chicago, as a senior hire, and also so easy to work with. So good at explaining things, knew when to encourage you, but never let you off the hook. So I knew I was being held to a standard of excellence. There was never that a question of that. And he was always encouraging. And the other graduate students and I used to joke that we would go in, this would always happen, we would go in and about a paper or draft or something, and he would say, this is so good, this is really great. And then he would tell you in, for the next 30 minutes all the things that you had done wrong and needed to fix, right? But he would preface it, and you knew he meant it, you know, so you felt encouraged.
No compliment sandwich, just...
No, yeah, it was like an open-faced sandwich.
Yeah, open-faced, which I think is more ideal anyways.
Yeah, exactly. Can I give you a couple other thoughts about it? That's my really practical, Renee Ong, if you're listening to this, I would absolutely collaborate with you again.
Shout out, come work with us.
Oh yeah.
Come to Discovery Day.
Come to Discovery Day. Then I was thinking about historical figures and trying to figure out whether or not I wanted to meet them. So I'm sure Einstein was a pain in the ass, but how can you not want to meet Einstein? There are a couple of visionaries that I wish I could meet, which is Einstein and Maxwell. Einstein, everyone knows about, probably the most visionary person perhaps ever in the history of humankind, in any field, not just in sciences. But Maxwell has always been someone I was in awe of because he took two very different fields, electricity and magnetism, which were totally separate fields at the time, and figured out how they were the same and how they predicted light, which was like a whole third field, optics, that we didn't think was related to either one. So Maxwell had a kind of genius that I think is sometimes underappreciated because students don't really like electricity and magnetism. So by the time they get to Maxwell, they're like, can we please just have the final exam and get out of here, you know? But Maxwell's really quite a genius. And Feynman, I wish I had met because he was supposed to be a really good leader. I've heard stories. So I was a postdoc at SLAC, Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. And there were stories about him at SLAC. And he would sit around at a table with a bunch of luminaries, all brilliant guys in the room, and listen to their opinion. He had the final say, but he had this great way of incorporating everybody's opinion, but still doing the right thing. And that's a terrific leader. I mean, that's impressive.
That's a wonderful leader. I think that's textbook leadership right there.
Exactly. And you don't find that in physicists very much.
What makes you say that?
Oh, they're not a social, we are not social creatures. So finding a physicist who is brilliant in their field and also really able to not only carry on a conversation, but really lead and understand people, I think is pretty remarkable.
I agree. Looking ahead, how do you see the future of space exploration evolving?
I am no expert on space exploration, but I'm going to say that I am very excited about the possibility that we're going to Mars. I think the Artemis missions are thrilling. And I grew up at a time when the space program was floundering. The Challenger blew up when I was 12, and I was at MIT for undergraduate, which at least they tell me has graduated more astronauts than any other institution, although no, I know NPS also has that accolade.
We have 44.
44, awesome. So I thought a lot about the astronaut program when I was an undergrad, and I was steered away from it. I was told it's dead or dying because the Challenger was such a huge setback. And they just, it seemed like they didn't know how to recover. Clearly it didn't die, but the Artemis mission, in my opinion, really getting us back on track. And I'm so excited to see them happening. And the technical challenges associated with going to Mars are being solved. And soon it will not be science fiction. Not very long from now, it will not be science fiction, I think.
Do you think there's a different life path where you could have been an astronaut?
Yeah. It is the one thing I regret not pursuing.
Really?
Yeah. I regret that the 17-year-old me who had just come to college and thought I could do this. I'm majoring in physics, which has more majors become an astronaut than any other. I'm at MIT, where clearly they know how to mold me in that way. I could do this, but I did not have the confidence to pursue it despite the discouragement. And so I gave it up for way too long. I did put in an astronaut application when I was 46. And at the time, the one thing I remember is, I mean, there are just thousands of applications every cycle. I remember that in the literature, they said, we take any age. And then it said, we've taken people as old as 42. It's like, you know, dudes, that is not any age, right? You should work on your PR a little bit.
By a long shot, not any age. Shot. 42, you barely know what you're doing in life.
I know, exactly. But the physical demands are huge, so I understand why. But they should just say they have basically de facto an age limit. There are some older astronauts that are going on missions now, but they got trained when they were younger.
A different life, a different path. I wouldn't regret it too much because without the current path you're on, you wouldn't have met your dissertation advisor, who is now one of your heroes, I would say. So
that's true. You can't do everything. And I remind myself of that a lot. I actually reflected recently, do I regret anything? And it's the only thing I could think of that I thought I did not give that the chance that I wish I had.
That's fair. And if that's your only regret, not such a bad life.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.